Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome to another episode of the Fell Into Food podcast. I'm your host, Chef Jeff Fell. Today, we have a seasoned professional in the food service industry specializing in produce, Jim Harity, Director of Corporate Sales for Get Fresh Produce. Jim's journey began at a family-owned assembly restaurant in Hoffman Estates, where he honed in his skills in purchasing. Transitioning to the distribution side, Jim later contributed his expertise to Sysco Food Service. After a few fruitful years, he seized an opportunity at Get Fresh Produce in 2005. Starting when Get Fresh was a small company, Jim witnessed its remarkable growth into a 200,000 square foot facility with 200 trucks, catering to a diverse customer base. With divisions like Grow Fresh, supplying independent grocery stores, and Garden Cut, specializing in pre-cut produce, Jim's role expanded. In 2019, Get Fresh Produce joined forces with Fresh Edge, broadening their footprint and enhancing operational systems. Today, Jim shares not only his knowledge of selling produce, but also insights into growing seasons and the critical aspects of the supply chain. Join us as we peel back a wide variety of topics all about produce. Today's podcast is sponsored by Invacus. Invacus provides vacuum packaging solutions for food service and packaging professionals. Their brands include Hinkleman vacuum sealers and GreenVac multi-purpose pans. This equipment can help operators save time, money, and allows kitchen teams to be more efficient in their day-to-day operations. I've been using the GreenVac pans and I absolutely love them and its marinating capabilities. I can reduce those times to minutes instead of hours. If you want to learn more, check out Invacus at Invacus.com. That's Invacus.com. Jim, thanks for coming on. Good to have you here. The winner right now, this Arctic Blast, because we're going to be talking produce. I literally was thinking of this on my drive in, was how does it affect, especially distributors, right? Not just from getting the produce from your guys' warehouse to the clients, but how does it affect the whole chain? Because I'm sure there's got to be something you have to do in order to secure product, right? I mean, somebody orders strawberries, you got to have strawberries. And then a lot of them, some customers may be picky about what they want, but others are like, I just need strawberries. What do you guys do to prepare? Like, is it in advance? Like, okay, snowstorm's coming and we need to pivot and get more supply. What do you guys do?
Yeah, by that time, it's a little bit too late to make that decision, right? So right now we're dealing with tomatoes. Tomatoes are a big issue with El Nino and the cold weather that's coming through Florida right now, and Mexico is done, so we're moving into Florida, and the warm weather isn't supporting the tomato crop, so we're having shortages. We have a big supply issue right now with tomatoes. You can't even get them because of the cold weather. So. Customers have to pivot. Maybe instead of using a plum tomato, they have to go to a 4x5 or a 4x4. You know, so there's a lot of weather is just, I mean, it has a lot to do with every item that we sell, you know, and especially, whether it's California or Florida or Mexico. When we get into these cold seasons, the markets just spike, and we have to adjust to them.
Yeah, and so you brought up the different regions, and it already leads me into the Yuma and the Salinas grow like season. That's something most people do not understand, what goes into a crop switchover, right? So explain a little bit what, like, the Yuma Salinas growing season. You may read about it, and people go, okay, what is that? Obviously, there's Salinas, California, and Yuma, Arizona. However, I don't think people understand what actually happens during those transitions. So maybe, like, what's the time frame of those happening?
So you and I have talked about this a number of times, right? So whenever you're looking at a transition from Salinas to Yuma, it's really due to weather. So they need warmer weather to grow crops. So twice a year, there's a big switch from Salinas, California, down to Yuma, and then back from Yuma to Salinas. And it's all based off of weathers, and when you're going down to the desert area, of course, it's hotter, so we could grow crops a lot quicker. So what they do is in Salinas, so if we're transitioning from Salinas to Yuma, what's happening is they break down the equipment and they ship it all down to Yuma. They don't have a facility down there, but they rebuild the whole. It's all over YouTube,
yeah, so,
right?
So is it just massive semis and they're literally just loading these?
Massive semis, you know, extra wide loads, and they're loading all these this crop equipment to go down there and basically do the same thing that they're doing in Salinas down to Yuma. And then we run into a gap, right, when usually a lot of times between Salinas and Yuma, when you're going between two different fields, sometimes those crops aren't ready. So we run into a gap in Western veg where product isn't available, and then we have to, you know, what happens when you get to the end of the crop, so say Salinas or Yuma, whichever one you want to take into account, what's going on is the plants get older. And when you get down to that end of the crop, they're more susceptible to disease, and they're more susceptible. You know, you get the real fluffy heads of lettuce, like, you know, when you go to the grocery store and you squeeze it, you know, when it's in prime season, you squeeze that head, it's hard as a rock, right? But as time goes on, those plants get weaker and they're not as strong. So the product gets lighter. It's not as hardy as the product that, you know, comes the first crop.
Yeah, and you get it's twice a year, right?
Twice a year.
November-ish, right?
Yeah, November is when we transition from Salinas down to Yuma, and then again in you know, April, late April.
Yeah, it's mostly leafy greens, correct?
For the most part, it's leafy greens. I mean, Salinas is always known for, you know, celery and cauliflower and broccoli and spinach and those type of items. But when those could be grown year round in Salinas, but when you're talking about leafy vegetables, those are the ones that are mostly affected.
The cycle time, the grow time is pretty quick on the veg side, right?
Right, right. So it grows, yeah. So it does. It grows quickly, but you need it's all dependent on weather. You know, this product is all grown outdoors. It's, you know, as soon as you clip it off, it starts dying, right? So we got to get it packed. We got to get it shipped. You know, you're talking about a 5-day ride back to, you know, Chicago, where we're from, right? So by the time the product already arrives in Chicago, you got 6 or 7 days on it from the time it was picked. And then you have to distribute it, and then it has to be sold, and then it has to be used. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into that supply chain management. And, you know, if you ever get out to Get Fresh and you go into our buyer's office, the president of the company, that's where he keeps his desk. Is in the buyer's office, because it's really the most important part of our company is buying produce.
Yeah. So with those I want to talk about how you kind of determine who you're going to work with. We can talk about the customer side.
Yeah.
But more on the producer side, right? There has to be a relationship with the farms, the farmer, whoever it might be. How does Get Fresh decide who they're going to work with? I'm sure, obviously, most companies probably work with some of the big guys because they can produce. But right. Is it local? Do you grab seasonality when it does hit? We're in the Midwest. It's cold a lot of the time. Can't get a lot of local fresh year round. So how do you determine who to use?
We always want to use AAA growers because, first of all, their product. You know, there's other growers out there that are less expensive. A lot of times, you go to your grocery stores, you might see some of those names. But in the food service end, we want to stick with the best growers, because number one, they have the best facilities, right? They have the food, all the food safety. Everybody pretty much has the food safety as far as when you're talking about these bigger growers. But those are some of the reasons that we want to stick with the main growers that you see, the Driscolls, the Andy Boy, the TNA. Those kind of companies just, you know, support us better than maybe a smaller one. We know the quality is going to be there. We know the time that the product will hold up better. And, you know, that those are some of the things that we want to make sure that we have when we're distributing the food service. And we understand that this product goes into a kitchen. It has to be prepared. It has to be put on a plate and then serve to our, you know, their customers.
I want to kind of get into what you've seen or heard. So, I mean, you may not have seen it firsthand, but heard from some of these growers with how things have changed over the past 10, 20 years.
Oh,
I know yesterday we briefly mentioned some fertilizer, some other things it's doing. I think it's really good for people to understand what's happening in the produce section of the industry and how technology is really starting to impact. And I think farmers are now really embracing what they have to do to survive.
Right. So you and I were talking yesterday a little bit about how they now do their weeding in a field, whereas in the past they would have to, you know, go down the rows, which you've seen, the rows of call it romaine, right? And they would have to spray weed killer in order to keep these fields sustainable. So what Church Brothers and other companies have done, and Andy Boy and all these bigger companies, is they came up with a robotic system that goes down the field, and it could pick out each weed and hit it with a microburst of weed killer, right? So it kills that weed and the plant doesn't get affected. So you're not just, you know, going down a line of in the field and spraying for weeds. This machine actually will kill that weed and save the plant.
That's mind blowing.
And it's crazy because you know, and you get into more technology with drones and with, you know, how that's you know, in areas of the fields that need more water, they have precipitation, you know, stems that go into these different these different farms, and it's just they know exactly where to water, what time of day is best to water. The weather reporting, everything that goes into all the different kinds of technology now used. And, you know, it really, I mean, stems from you want to get the most out of your labor that you have. You know, there's new picking, you know, robotics that are picking product out of the fields. And the industry is just totally changing, and who knows what 10 years is going to be like. And we've talked about, you know, vertical growing and how that's going to come into play, right? I mean,
yeah, you're seeing it at like Costco. Right? I was just there this weekend, and you've got your regular berries that are massive. And then there's these, I keep seeing these greenhouse grown,
right?
I don't even know how it's marketed, but it's got to be clearly grown in some sort of indoor facility. And I haven't kept up enough with, I knew there was some startup that were trying to do some of that, especially in the Midwest, to cut down on costs. But I don't know if you've heard anything about
piece. Let's talk about, you know, Mighty Vine Tomatoes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really kind of taken the industry by storm. And you know, their whole system came out of Holland, you know, with the Holland peppers and how they grew Holland peppers indoors. So Mighty Vine then took that same model and they started growing these tomatoes, and it's really, I mean, if you ever had one, I mean, they taste like something that you would grow right out of your garden. And the reason that they've become so popular is because, first of all, you know, they have product year round. The product that you get is actually ripened on the vine. It's not, you know, it's not shipped to you green and then gassed, right? So you get that taste.
Pause there. No one knows about, I tell people, and I'm like, the tomato you're eating really isn't red.
Right.
It's been, what is that process?
Right. So say you're getting tomatoes. So that's a great question because, you know, tomatoes, when you get them from Florida, right, you got to ship them up when they're green. You can't ship them up when they're red because they bruise easy, right? They're not, they won't make that transport, or California or Mexico or wherever you're getting your tomatoes from. So they come up green. And then what we do, they have like a little bit of pink on them. So then what we do is, or what is done is they're gassed. So that once we get them on the truck to bring them up north, they start ripening, and that's really the ripening process. Is that they start ripening, and then we bring them in and we ripen them up to, you know, coke color red, you know, to send them out to our customers. So the process of tomatoes is, you know, we always think that, oh, Michigan has the best, or Illinois has the best tomatoes. And the reason that we do is because they're ripened on the vine, that, you know, we don't have to ship them. So when we get a fresh tomato out of the garden, The reason it tastes good is because it's ripened on a vine. We don't get it green and then put it on a counter and let it ripen, right? We pick it off the vine. Oh, that tomato's red, so we take it.
Yeah, it's getting more nutrients. It's getting developing flavor naturally.
Naturally, being prematurely pulled
and then...
Exactly. So that's even, you know, when you cut a tomato, right, when it's ripened on a vine, it's just got a different taste. It's got a different texture.
Completely different texture. It's not firm. It's firm, but it's not what you see in the winter at the grocery store.
Right.
You cut into it's super firm, and you're like, oh, this is super easy to cut tomato. And it's almost that light tint red. It's not the deep, like the Coke red where you can really tell. And
obviously
the flavor profile is completely different.
Yeah, it is different. And that's why companies that are doing these greenhouse tomatoes or whatever are really kind of getting more and more popular. And it's just really because of that taste that we're talking about and why restaurants prefer, you know, whether it's Mighty Vine or a different company, they want those, you know, hot house tomatoes where they have that taste. You just don't get them when you get a tomato from California or Florida and ship them up here to Illinois. It just doesn't have that same flavor.
Yeah, I've been to the ripening room. It's a good break from the cold warehouse, and then you walk into the ripening room and all of a sudden you get hit with this heat. What other items do you ripen? Bananas, right?
Bananas are one of them. I mean, avocados, of course, is a big one for us. We go through a lot of avocados and you know, we have people that just, you know, monitor this product all day long and then they decide when to pull it out. And, you know, you can't pull it out when it's too ripe. And, you know, I mean, when a restaurant orders avocados, there's, you know, three different ways they could get them, right? They could get them green, they could get them on the turner, they could get them ripe. And those are the three, you know, different stages. And then you got bananas. There's seven different stages, you know. And then there's you know, just papayas or, you know, mangoes or whatever.
Stuff probably
whatever
more
that's
tropical
coming in.
Or coming, I guess, Central America, South America, potentially, that comes up. Because that time's got to be even sooner than a California crop, right? You're getting something
from. And one other point is that we don't ripen anything with ethanol gas. Right, so you get more of a natural ripening when we do it with heat. So that the ripening room that you said, you know, you go in from 33 degree or 34 degree cooler into a ripening room, and it's 70 degrees. And what that does is it just brings out instead of using ethanol gas, which is you know, which would do it quicker. We've come up with a system that, you know, by using heat to ripen bananas and tomatoes and avocados, it just seems to work better for us, and we get a better product.
Does having the I can't remember, are the bananas in their own room or are they with all the others?
Yeah, so
they release their own gas,
right? So they can actually gas is whether, yeah, so we put the bananas in, yeah, the bananas are in the ripening room, and avocados are, and all those items that need to be ripen. Of course, you keep other products out of there, right? Apples and all those items are on the other side of the warehouse because you want to keep, you know, we have ethanol scrubbers actually that take away that that gas in the warehouse.
So the bananas that are releasing that natural gas, you're actually just extracting it and just letting the heat then, so that way it doesn't potentially turn stuff faster. So you have more controls.
Yeah, and you don't want ethanol gas in your warehouse either, because it'll turn other products quicker, right? And then you're going to have different issues. But yeah, so that's really part of our ripening process. It's really fascinating to see, and like I said, you know, we always invite people to come out to Get Fresh and see what we're doing and how our processes are, and it's amazing to see. It's a you know, when you walk through it, you just get a whole different feel to
it changes your perception on the buying piece when you get to see how it's handled, and what, especially from my experience, what Get Fresh does with the facilities, how clean it was, safety. Like, I mean, everyone's stopping, making sure that there's no forklifts hitting any. I mean, they're buzzing around, but in a pretty safe way. So you got a new facility being built. I'm super excited because I saw it going up. I remember when you had mentioned it to me about how the new facility's coming along, but you're moving the fresh cut.
Yeah, so right now we're doing a lot of processing. It's called Garden Cut, and that's our cut division. So we could take any item from any kind of fruit or vegetable or whatever and slice it, dice it to whatever the customer needs are, right? So a lot of the product that we do now is for manufacturers, food manufacturers, and they like to receive items in bulk. They like to receive them. They want it clean, they want it washed, and they just want it ready to use. And, you know, when we started Garden Cut, it started off, you know, we're pretty much going to do a lot of restaurants and a lot of these different kinds of cuts that restaurants needed. And then you get into then you start getting into this food manufacturing where people are, you know, whether it's prepared meals or it's soup companies or, you know, or beef or just about any processor uses fresh cut vegetables, and that's kind of where we're leaning towards with this new facility that we have, and it's going to be all state of the art. It's a huge facility. It's a huge undertaking. The machinery that's in there, the cutting, the processing, we have X-ray machines that before product goes out, you know, it goes down a conveyor belt to make sure there's no foreign objects in that product. The food safety that is involved when you're buying cut product. And it takes away a lot of labor inside a kitchen or inside of a manufacturer. And, you know, a part of it is, again, is food safety. And these, you know, they want to receive product that is ready to use, that they know is going to be safe, that they can serve their customers. And, you know, we talk about where the industry has gone, like 25 years. When I first started with Get Fresh, I started in 2005, and there was a big push for food safety, right? That was like the main thing that everybody was talking about, because we started to see these food. Everybody knows the Chipotle story about, you know, how they were buying product and, you know, the proper recalls or whatever weren't in place, and we found that in early in 2000s that, you know, these big chains, especially the big chain restaurants, that they wanted accountability. They wanted to know where that product was coming from. They wanted recall systems in place. If there was a problem, if there was a recall, that they wanted to be notified within, you know, a couple hours of that recall going out, that their product has been affected by it. So that's really what catapulted Get Fresh, I believe, that in the beginning years, is that we put those processes in effect. We had a third party audit. You know, we had a company that came out and they go through your warehouse. They make sure that you have that you don't have any expired product in house. That the recall systems are in place. That, you know, that there's proper cleaning processes for the floors, for the employees, for, you know, so they do an in-depth in-depth look at how the facilities run, then they give you a score, and we always scored in the high 90s, 98-99%, and, you know, these big national accounts, they want to see that. They want to make sure that you're able to, you know, have a recall in place, or that you're buying product that they know is GAP certified, that, you know, that product is, when you're buying from farms that have proper wash techniques, that you're buying from farms that, you know, have all these GMP, you know, all these proper HACCP, all the bells,
well,
and whistles.
One little mishap to a, we've seen with Chipotle,
right?
I mean, it's millions of dollars.
Yeah. It was almost $1 billion.
So it makes sense to have those certifications and make sure that food is safe for the public. And because as of late, we've seen a lot more, especially on the leafy green side with the salmonella outbreaks.
Salmonella. And
it's really, you know, again, becoming more and more.
Yeah. Again, you touched on everything. And I, you know, our trucks are, they, you know, when you do these audits, they come in and they look at your trucks and how they're holding temperatures and making sure that product, when it's shipped out, that it's at the product, that the product's at the temperature that, you know,
Do you think that some of these recalls are happening more because of some of the labor shortages out in the fields? Because potentially some shortcuts are happening. I'm not saying that is or isn't true, but I didn't know if you have a belief, if you would think potentially, because they seem to be happening more and more, even though we're getting more and more food safety protocols put in place. You keep seeing, it's like, it feels like every year there's some sort of either romaine, spinach, some sort of leafy green. Now, obviously cut, fruit is different. That's usually happening at the processing facility. Like, again, not at yours, but at processing facilities because they're not potentially doing it the right way.
Right.
So I didn't know if you like believe.
Yeah. In I always tell this one funny story is when I was walking through a well-known restaurant and I was watching them make coleslaw. Right. So they have to they take the cabbage and they shred it. So I'm watching the guys preparing the cabbage and the guy's sitting there. He's got, you know, the triple wash sink and he's washing the heads of cabbage. And just I asked the manager at the time, or the person who was taking me through this. I go, why is he washing the head of the, he should be washing it after it's shredded, right? Because what happens is when cabbage is grown in a field, right, a bird can be flying over, it defecates on a head of cabbage, and all the leaves grow around it. So, you know, it's something that, you know, really nobody even thinks about. Even like when you're cutting lettuce at home or whatever, some people just wash the outside of the lettuce. You actually got to wash it after it's cut.
You hear that, everyone? Wash your cabbage, wash your lettuce, because you might have bird poop inside. That's keep going.
But no, that's part of the, you know, that's part of the process that we you know, that those are part of the processes that, you know, I think a lot of people have gotten onto this, and you know, especially the major chains, and you know, they all know proper protocols now. But you know, you're looking 20, 25 years ago, and you're talking about, yeah, our recalls becoming more prevalent now than they were, you know, 5 years ago, and it sure does seem that way. And maybe it's because of the, you know, some of the technology that's out there that can identify when there's a problem with, whether it's a lettuce or an onion or whatever that product is. And, you know, they say, oh yeah, this, you know, after doing a test, it did come back with, you know, pathogen in it. So, I think that probably has a lot to do with it. I think that companies are testing products a lot more, and, you know, sometimes they, you know, they pop and they have to then create a recall, and, you know, we're notified within probably about a half hour of that recall, right? We identify it, and we can identify the lot, we can identify the box, we can identify who received that product, and you know, that's really part of the processes that are now in place. And most of the bigger companies now have all those recall systems in place.
And it's a lot safer to buy whole produce and then cut it down yourself most of the time, because again, I think you hear a lot of the recalls happening and it's pre-cut this, pre-that, or whatever, even though it's triple washed and the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
That's where it seems, and to me, that leads to the production facilities.
Yeah.
Not necessarily potentially the farm. It's kind of the same analogy I use with restaurants. Right. Everyone goes into a restaurant, they go home, they get sick. What's the first thing you do? Oh, that restaurant got me sick.
Yeah.
Well, did you even wash your hands before you ate?
Yeah.
And if you ask 9 out of 10 people, the answer is probably no. And it's like, well, you've been probably touching the same menus and the same everything that everyone else has been touching. You don't know they're coming in sick, and who knows what if they wash their hands or not. And then all of a sudden, but they just blame the restaurant. They don't take any accountability on their own. And it's like, wash your hands, and you probably won't get sick near as much as you think you do. Because fortunately, I've never had food poisoning ever. All my years going to restaurants, being in it.
I don't know if you would know. I mean, a lot of times, unless you get ill where you're throwing up, you know, it's coming out both ends. I mean, there's no way of actually knowing whether,
am
I sick, you know, am I sick because I'm just, you know, not feeling well, or was it something I ate, you know? So yeah, to your point, I don't know if I've ever gotten that kind of food poisoning where, you know, you hear people saying that, oh, it's throwing up all night, or, you know,
I hear it more and more. People will just randomly say, oh, I got food poisoning, don't go to this restaurant. And it's that one's, I've heard really good things, and I've never heard, I'm gonna just chalk it up to the probably didn't wash your hands. That's my guess. And then you ask them what you ate. Oh, I had a burger. Oh, well, you're not touching the food and it's going in your mouth. But you mentioned onions, and I want to touch on onions, potatoes.
Yeah.
And that fascinating, I think there's documentaries on even Netflix about it, what that process is, because they get put into these big giant barns for a long, long time before you even get it. Everyone's like, oh, that onion's not ripe. Or it's like, well, that onion's probably been sitting in a warehouse for, what, 8 months?
Yeah, you get it until August, and you're getting into some pretty old potatoes. But yeah, so let's take potatoes, for instance, because I think that's probably one everybody could identify with. You know, potatoes only harvested once a year in Idaho, right? So that usually happens around August. And that's when they go in and they start to plow the fields, pull up the potatoes. And then the potatoes have to sit on the field for about 10 days. So they have to make sure, those farmers have to make sure there's not going to be any rain, that there's not going to be any kind of frost. I don't know if you remember, but about 5 or 6 years ago, in September, early September, they had a snowstorm out in Idaho or a frost. I can't remember which one it was. But what they started to do, they started to light the sides of the fields on fire because they wanted to save these crops. So they had to keep the temperature, right? They had to keep the temperature down in these fields. So they were actually lighting the fields on fire to try to you know, save these crops. So it's become, again, this is technology. This is, these guys are better than the weathermen, because they know that these 10 days, they're going to pull these crops up, right? And then they have to sit out on a field, whether it's onions or potatoes, they have to sit out on a field and cure for 10 days before they put them into these sheds. These sheds are massive, right? They're football field long by wide, and there's you know,
it's hard to imagine football field filled and filled. How tall they are.
Yeah.
And how many products.
So potatoes are harvested only one time a year, right? So then they're stored all the way through until the new crop, which is next August or September. So when you start getting into those later periods of time, you know, those potatoes have quite a bit of age on them. But it's, like I said, they don't know what that crop is going to look like until they start digging. So they don't know what kind of crop they will have for the next year. This year, you talk about this year. Last year was a terrible year, right? Last year, you were paying $35, $40 for a case of potatoes. This year, you're paying, you know, $20 to $25 for a case of potatoes. And that's just, you know, that's just because they had a better crop than they did the prior year. And you know, some of it's manufactured and some of those.
Yeah, and the end consumer doesn't realize that's why prices fluctuate. They don't understand that it starts right at the farm, how that crop is producing, what the yield per acre is, or whatever that metric is. I grew up on corn and soybean farm, so it's bushels per acre, and it depends on how much you're producing, you know, how well those crops are doing. That affects the end user, but they don't see it. You know, they see these spikes and fluctuations based upon these crops that are once a year, and it's still going up and down based upon, like you said, all the supply chain factors that go into produce. It's a lot. It really is, from grower to processing facility to get it ready, to then the shipping logistics that go into it, then getting it into distribution, then into the end user, whether that be restaurant, food service establishment, grocery store. That's a pretty lengthy process.
We talked about this yesterday as well. I mean, every single item, every single produce item, every single fruit, there's a story behind it, right? And whether it's a tomato or celery or whatever it is, there's always some kind of story behind that item, whether avocados, and you know, you're dealing with border blockages from, you know, the cartel, or you know, to bring in
that's
product.
A real thing. When that happened, was it 3 years ago? Three, four years ago?
Limes and avocados both went crazy. Yeah.
And I got the alert.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was from you guys, whoever from produce, and they said, hey, FYI, avocado prices are about to spike. The cartel is holding them hostage.
Yeah.
I started telling people, I'm like, if you need avocado, get them now. I go, just bulk up, throw them in your freezer. And they all laughed. They're like, ha ha ha. I was like, I'm not joking.
Yeah.
The cartel literally is holding up the avocados and holding the farmers to pay a ransom to get their products through.
Yeah, they wouldn't let them cross
the
border.
On NBC, 5 months later, or not 5 months, but a few weeks later, or a couple days later, people are like, oh, you weren't joking. No, it wasn't joke. Why would I come up with a story to tell you that avocados are going to spike because of cartel?
Yeah, you know, and avocados, there's really, you know, you see the difference in pricing, and these farmers, they kind of control that market, right? So if the avocados start getting too cheap, they leave them on. You could leave avocados on a tree for as long as you need to, right?
I mean,
6 months or 12 months. Wow. You could leave them. You don't have to pick them right away, right?
Do they keep growing then?
Yeah, they keep growing, but they're smaller ones, right? So a lot of times when you see the, you know, products starting to come over quickly or whatever, there's a lot of small fruit that's available. Fruit meaning avocados is fruit. So, you know, when we're bringing in avocados, a lot of people are like, well, why are they so expensive? And again, you know, it could be Easter weekend. They don't work. They don't go and pick, you know, the Mexican people are very religious, right? So they take off that whole week of Easter. And they don't, so we kind of plan ahead, right? We know that, hey, it's going to be hard to get avocados.
Nobody thinks, like, I wouldn't even think of that.
Yeah.
They're not picking this for a whole week, so it's going to dictate.
Picking this product, and whether it's avocados or it's, I mean, we talk about lettuces, you know, if you have too much rain out west, you can't get a tractor out into the field, right? So then we have a shortage, right? So then they're like, oh, well, why is lettuce going up? Well, because there's no lettuce available. It's all underwater right now. We're waiting for
the romaine fields. Was it last year the romaine spiked incredible? Wasn't it the rain that caused?
There's always seems to be something that pops up. But yeah, the romaine was an issue, and just getting into the fields to pick the product. Celery was an issue a few years back as well, where, you know, went to cauliflower. Cauliflower has been an issue for a while. So there's always something that seems to be making the markets move, right? And that's it's mostly due to weather. You know, during the pandemic, it was due to transportation. We couldn't get trucks. We were paying more for trucks. So, you know, the product price, you know, spiked because of that. And then, you know, labor was hard to get. So these farms and all these growers are starting to pivot. They're starting to move towards better technology, like we talked about, to minimize those labor costs, because it's getting so expensive to grow this product. And, you know, that's why a lot of the fields are moving down to Mexico, where, you know, water is abundant. We know about the water shortages in California, right? So, you know, again, it's, you know, getting off on different categories, but it just always seems to be like there's something that's moving the markets. Now everybody's starting to look towards, you know, because freight was getting so expensive. Everybody's starting to look to bring in product through rail, right?
Really?
So you're bringing one of those big rail trucks that you see on
that stops you at the stoplight. You're pissed off because you got to wait 5 minutes.
Looking, and you're like, why? You know, one of those big freight trucks is equal to 3 semis. So when you're looking at, you know, so. There's ways that we're trying to save money, pass those savings along to our customers as well, and make us more competitive in the market. And those are some of the ways, is, you know, transportation costs.
Back to tech in your new facility.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned something to me yesterday that blew my mind with the new cut facility and what you are planning to do, how it's being built with some of the waste. People don't realize there is obviously. You go to a restaurant, you know, you're not getting 100% yield out of your celery or your tomato, whatever product it is. You're just not. There's going to be ends, and people do their best to utilize it that they can. But when you're getting that pre-cut, you can't just reutilize it. You know, it's in a processing facility. Talk about some of that new tech that you guys are doing with the scraps and how it's then being repurposed and utilized versus just being thrown away.
Yeah. So when you know, a lot of the items that we use, they have, you know, a 30% loss, right? So if you're bringing in 100,000 pounds of produce, you have about 30,000 pounds of waste. So one of the biggest contributors to cost and expense that we were having was how to get rid of that waste, right? They have these waste companies coming in and picking up product. And right now at our current facility, when they pick up product, it's waterlogged. It's filled with water, and that adds to the weight, and that's part of your cost, right? Is the waste that is involved in all this product that you're dealing with, to have these companies come and pick up this product. All it gets very, very, very expensive. So what we have now in our new facility is, it's going to be an underground system where the waste goes underground, goes into a belt, and takes it, and it basically grinds it down. It grinds it down to a fine, you know, to
like a pulpy
to type, a pulpy type mixture, right? And then what happens is they have an extractor that takes all the water out. So it becomes one big block. Say they're doing celery that day, or they're doing cabbage, and it becomes one big block of vegetables. And what we're doing then is we're going to use it for compost, or some farmers will use it, pig farms will use it to feed their animals, or, you know, whatever, wherever we can get rid of that. But it's not only a sustainable concept, but it also helps us control our costs, right? And make you know, buying pre-cut vegetables more affordable to the end user.
Yeah, and that's always what's hard with the end user, is it's, oh, I'd love to get pre-cut. Right. However, it's just so expensive because of what goes into the processing, because obviously you guys are taking on that labor cost. However, in this new model, like, you can hopefully get the cost down to where it is more competitive and gives people more of an option or an opportunity with these labor shortages to have some pre-cut in certain areas, right? People, chefs are going to pick and choose what they want to have ready, what they don't. Like, to me, carrot sticks, it's one of the most labor-intensive, painstaking tasks. It's like, why? Why? I'll just buy a carrot stick. Like, they're all different sizes to get a nice square cut, yeah, or what you want out of a stick. Yeah. It's like, why? Why, yeah, when there are people that do this for a living and they get the max yield out of a carrot?
Right.
No, obviously, if you don't have that luxury, well, then great. But you're between peeling the carrot, getting it down, and then you have, you know, the end user has the waste of that product too.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a restaurant chain out there right now that they don't even have a knife in the kitchen. You know, they took away the knives because the liability of what it costs if somebody cuts themselves, or, you know, severs a tendon or something in their hand, you know, it could be $100,000 in medical bills. So, yeah. So part of the pre-cut, you know, you always, you know, you're a chef, and, you know, I go to try to sell you something that's pre-cut, you're going to be like, oh, you know what? I got somebody who's working in the kitchen right now. He could easily cut that product. And, you know, when he's not doing something, I can give him a bag of onions to cut, right? And that's great, but the whole thing is that, you know, we've learned with the cost, you know, now people are making what, $20-$25 an hour working in the kitchen, and that's pretty average, you know. It's
20, especially in this market, the Chicago market. Anything under 20, even for the dishwasher, is a no go. People go, no, I can make $20,
yeah,
down the street.
So when you're going in right now and you're buying a burger and you're having a burger and you know, at a restaurant, and it's costing you $19-$20, where years ago it was costing you $12, right? A lot of that cost is labor that goes into, you know, running a restaurant right now is the labor cost. So that's why we really started to push this pre-cut facility, right? It's because, you know, with all the costs of labor and all the, you know, trying to find good people to work for you, you know, you don't want them anymore just sitting in the back cutting vegetables. There's other things that they can be doing that's possibly more productive, especially if it's a quality employee, right, in a kitchen, which we know is.
Yeah, and nobody, you know, wants to be the guy that has to sit in the kitchen all day and, yeah, cut the onions.
Right.
Whether it be sliced, whatever end use that you have. Nobody wants to sit there for 6 hours and be doing that task over and over again. It's boring. It's methodical.
Yeah.
Some people stick to it. I couldn't. I mean,
it's laborious.
It's laborious, exactly. Casino days, it was, you rotated around, and it was like, all right, you got 200 pounds of onions to clean and cut for sauteed onions, grilled onions. You just dreaded it. You knew that day was coming, and you're just going to be in the kitchen all day cutting onions.
Right. And onions, you know, we talk about, you've been through our processing facility, and onions come in. And these big bins, right? Now, and then we got to peel them. So you got to buy this machine that costs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to peel an onion. You got, and basically what it does, it takes the two tops off, then spins it and takes the skin off of it, right? So these machines, all, you know, all this goes into that cost of the product to sell, right? And, you know, over time, yeah, does it make more sense to buy processed product already cut? You know, it's proven that it does, you know, just because you think that you're saving money by having somebody else cut it in a kitchen, but when you're paying $20 an hour to have a guy clean a bag of onions and cut them.
And their skill level.
And their skill level, right.
You get a regular person off the street, they're, you're going to spend how many hours teaching them how to cut an onion properly?
Right.
What's your yield? Because you're probably going to have a lot lower yield because they're going to clean more off of it. A lot of people whack off a giant chunk on the top and the bottom, depending right. on what they're doing. So your yield goes down from, you know, that 20, 30% loss. It could be 40%, 50% yeah. if they don't know what they're doing. So any other tech in that new facility from a distribution, or is it really that pre-cut is the crown jewel of the new facility?
Yeah, the pre-cut is definitely the crown jewel. I mean, the machinery that's going in there to process this product. We do tons of the spiro noodles, and we have a machine that actually spirals a zucchini.
I was there that one day. They were spiralizing, and it's just the speed is just flowing through those machines.
Yeah, and you know, same with vegetables as well as prepared meals. Right now, we're seeing all these prepared meals in Costco's and Mariano's and Jewel. Right, you see all these meals that people are just could walk out with. And now you're starting to see a lot more that pre-cut of whether it's fruit or vegetables or whatever it is starting to grow. You know, I had a call the other day with a client that's a very large client, but they're looking to do, they're like for Thanksgiving, they want to have you know, the celery and onions already diced and ready to go for when people make stuffing, right? So there's all these different ideas as far as pre-cuts go, and grocery stores are really starting to gravitate towards that.
Yeah, you see those sections growing.
Especially the boutique-y type places,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you go in and you'll see this. Yeah. You know, there's the produce, and then it's the pre-cut and ready-to-go stuff. It's almost as big as the produce now, the cooler, you know, where it's spraying the water down. It's mind-blowing. It's people at home either don't have the skill,
right,
the techniques. And could it be a new generation coming potentially that don't want to do some of these laborious things that, you know,
right,
older generations? I have no problem. I actually enjoy it in the kitchen sometimes.
Yeah.
Or at home, because it keeps those skills honed, because I'm not in the kitchen all day, every day doing those things just to keep them sharp. But I got gizmos and gadgets to do some of that for me. And then in a pinch, I'm like, no, I don't have the time. Yeah, I got two littles. I don't have time to spend all day cutting. I'm going to the store and I'm getting it ready to go for.
Yeah. Me. Yeah. You go into Costco, you go in that cooler, you see all the trays of vegetables or the trays of fruit, and it's becoming a big item for them. They're moving a lot more of it. And that's kind of why we're starting to pivot into that category as well. That's a main focus of ours.
That's awesome. Yeah. So I want to jump into the weeds. So I'm going to shoot some questions off from the hip. Fruit or veg that most people have never tried but should.
Fruit and veg. So yeah, I Brussels sprouts, right? You know, we go back 5-6 years ago, nobody was buying Brussels sprouts. Nobody was, I think, you know, you have your, you know what else is, I don't think gets a lot of play in the retail market is broccolini. And I would say that would probably be one of the items that I would push. I think it's a very tasty item. There's so many different recipes for it, but I think broccolini just doesn't get that play in the retail market, and I don't think people utilize, you know, when they do see it, they know how to cook it or what to use it for. Again, I go back to Brussels sprouts. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, nobody really was buying Brussels. We sell maybe 20 cases a week or whatever. Now it seems like, you know, I mean, there's small Brussels sprouts, there's shredded Brussels sprouts, there's, you know, there's half Brussels sprouts. There's, you know, and it's becoming one of the biggest commodities that we sell. You know, it's one of the bigger commodities. Maybe, you know, one day it will overtake broccoli or whatever, but it's just like one of those items that really started to catch on. And you could probably say the same thing for avocados, right? You know, 20 years ago, nobody was eating avocados, and all of a sudden everybody,
avocado toast, avocado mash, right?
Everybody's avocado salsa, right?
You can get anything avocado.
You can get everything. Yeah. So
Brussels, you got to roast them and then drizzle them in balsamic, or you got to cook them with bacon. Those are the two methods. Or a nice Brussels sprout salad. You can't go wrong. It's just that it just tastes fresh.
Yeah.
And crisp. And I think I agree with you on that one.
I guess it's the preparation and how
it is
how people
if you just cook it and like blah yeah it's
boil
a,
it
it's
like,
a
you know,
bag of, yeah. It's a pile of mush.
Yeah,
it's gross.
Little cabbages, right?
Or have you ever tried sweet chili on it?
No,
roast
that sounds
them,
good.
And you take some sweet chili.
And just toss it in
sweet chili, and then you just eat it. Gives it a whole nother complexity because, again, most of the time it's just bacon or traditional balsamic glaze or something on it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, if you could grow one exotic fruit in your backyard, what would it be?
Probably avocados.
Avocados, really?
I don't know if that's exotic, but I think that would be right.
Yeah, that's what you grow?
It's one of the items that I really, really like. Exotic fruit. You know, there's a reason it's exotic. It's because a lot of times it's not that great. No. You know,
you don't want to be growing Durum in your backyard?
Yeah, right.
The big smelly fruits.
You have star fruit. You know, you got your passion fruits. You got your, you know, I don't know if you want to even consider persimmons.
I love persimmons. Persimmon pudding, most underutilized,
right?
Way of persimmon. I don't know. Maybe it's because that's how my great grandmother cooked them. She made this persimmon pudding. To die for. I love persimmons.
And they're not just available anymore over Christmas. So,
all right. Pizza toppings, classic or adventurous?
Adventurous. You know, I love. I'm gonna go out there and say I like pineapple.
You're a pineapple on the pizza guy.
Yeah, I do kind of like the pineapple, but
oh my goodness,
you know,
I'm not an elitist where I say you can't put pineapple on pizza, but it's not.
I get it. I just like pineapple on my pizza, but usually just a cheese and sausage guy. You know.
All right. Best piece of advice you've received in your food service career?
I guess what you don't know. When you first start in this business and you just don't know that, you know, that customer, that client, you know, is not approachable, or that client's not, you can never sell to, you know, maybe a McDonald's or something like that, right? A big company. I guess the best advice I ever got is just don't ever write anybody off. Don't ever write anything off that can't be sold, or they can't use your products, because, you know, sometimes that small little to get into a company with one product will lead to many other things. And just being persistent and coming up with different ideas to go after that client. It's probably the best advice I could give someone. And like I said, you know, be naive. You know, call the Costco's or whoever it might be, and you know, you never know. Sometimes
even
you get
getting shut
back.
Down is a learning opportunity to understand what those clients are looking for. Okay, for the next big one, those are some of the questions that I should ask. But you'll never know if you never try.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes you call these people and you're kind of expecting not to get anybody live on a phone, right? And then all of a sudden somebody will pick up the phone and be like, "Hi, guy, speak to, you know, the person who purchases produce or whatever." Oh, that'd be me. And then you start a conversation, and that conversation just gets that's your first step, right? Is that initial conversation, kind of, you know, give them a little bit of background about yourself and, you know, what you're doing and what's new in the industry, and kind of just have a story to tell, an interesting story too, not just
nobody wants a boring story.
Right.
All right, last one. Someone looking to get into the produce business, what would you say to them?
I would say it's a very lucrative. It is a good business to be in because it's the markets are volatile, right? So there's always ways to either, you know, at times to make pretty good money. I think a lot of the people that we have that have come into produce sales or whatever have some kind of food service background behind them, whether they're chefs or they're purchasers, they've been on the purchasing end. That's always a good place to get. I think to get started and then start to
then branch
know,
apply, out into the tree.
Apply into you know different you know distribution companies and take any job that you can and you know grow from there. You know it's a great industry to be in. It's a moving industry. It's exciting. There's always new products coming out. There's always you know new ideas and it's a fun industry to be a part of.
I love it. That's all I've got. Where should people go if they want to know more about GetFresh, if they need to get in contact with you to get some produce, great stuff, where do they go?
Yeah, go to GetFreshProduce.com or else give me a call. You know, my cell phone number is always, my cell phone is always on. You know, you can call me on my cell at 224-828-4260. And love to hear from you, love to talk to you. So I appreciate you.
I hope your phone just blows up after it gets released and you're just like, oh, God.
I do too.
Not that big yet, but we'll get there one day. But yeah, appreciate you coming on Talking Produce. This was a blast. Until next time, if you need anything from produce, go to GetFresh for all the best produce.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.